There's something in between you and me, the radio, or the computer, or whatever device you're listening to. And that's true for, well, maybe for most of the voices you hear. Your favorite singers, the actors on your favorite TV shows, and of course your favorite radio hosts. You hear all of them thanks to technology, specifically signal processing. And as media historian Jonathan Stern tells Craig Ely, signal processing shapes the sound of all vocal media, from your telephone calls to the music of T-Pain.
When most people think about media, they think about those two things, the performers, the actors in a movie, the musicians making the music, and then they think about themselves listening to it. Signal processing is all the stuff that happens to sound in between those things, and it usually happens to it while sound is either electricity or digital data inside of a computer.
What's the importance of us learning what's going on in there?
I can't emphasize this enough. Our media aesthetics have nothing to do with what people do in rooms when they're in front of each other. The way voices sound, the way musical instruments sound, what's considered realistic, none of that has anything to do with what we think of as good sound when we're listening to the radio or listening to music. My voice right now is running through a Neumann U87 microphone, which is an industry standard. And the thing about this industry standard is it has certain, according to the tastes of radio engineers, euphonic characteristics. In other words, it makes stuff sound better than it sounds without it. But there's this other thing, and that's compression. The compression I'm talking about right now was first used in radio in the 1930s. And what it does is it reduces the difference between the quietest part of the sound and the loudest part of the sound. Most mediatic voices that we think sound good, whether we're talking about telephones, mobile phones, radio, singing, and popular music, are highly compressed, so much so that if you heard a voice that wasn't compressed, you would say they did something wrong to it.
You mentioned in terms of compression that there are two different kinds of compression, right? One is this dynamic range limiting. What's the second kind?
Yeah, the second kind is data compression, which is basically making files smaller. The idea is that bandwidth is the most expensive thing, and this is something your listeners can check every month when they look at their mobile phone bills. And this has been true pretty much for the history of communications. So what Bell did is they got interested in, like, what is the minimum amount of sound people need in order to discern speech? Can we build filters so that we can send more phone calls down the same size line and still have it be intelligible at the other end?
What were sort of the nuts and bolts of how you get more voices in the same pipe?
Well, okay, so one of the things they tried to do is determine the frequency range in which speech occurs. What they figured out is the mid-range is really the important part of hearing. In other words, you can get rid of a lot of the highs and a lot of the lows. And so you can basically lop off the ends of the sound and people can still understand what's happening at the other end of the line.
I want to go back, though. I want to focus a little bit more kind of specifically on the voice and this relationship between, you know, what we might consider the actual physical experience of singing or listening and its recorded form. I mean, I've heard it said about Bing Crosby or Sinatra that their real genius was learning that the voice actually wasn't their instrument. Their instrument was the microphone.
Yeah.
And this sort of continues to this day with kind of stylized vocal technologies like autotune.
Yeah, there's a lot to say about autotune. So the first thing is pitch correction has been a holy grail of the music industry since at least the 1960s. And there are many different technologies that have been used for pitch correction. Of course, it's also used as an artistic effect. And this is one of the things that people get confused about autotune. There's Cher's Believe, which is one of the most famous uses, where somebody's basically playing her voice through a keyboard. So sad. That's very different from the main use of autotune in professional studios, which is more like touch-up in Photoshop. Mm-hmm. You're getting rid of red eye in your, like, cheap photo editing program.
Right. I mean, when autotune is done well, we're not supposed to hear it, right?
That's exactly right. But, of course, the most famous autotune uses are the obvious and egregious ones. And today's modern Bing Crosby, I would say you could go to T-Pain. Yeah. who has, you know, sort of built his career on the use of auto-tune, except it's important to say that that's in a whole tradition of black soul singing, mm-hmm. where doing weird mechanical things to your voice has a long tradition. Also in funk, you think about Cernoz Devoid of Funk and the Old Parliament Funkadelic records. You know what you can do with your funk star child? You will never see me dance. And actually what Cher's doing, well, or Cher's producers are doing in Believe is drawing on that African-American tradition.
So let me ask you this, though, because this question of auto-tune, it seems to me occasionally fraught with issues of authenticity and issues of performance. Is this a problem?
Not for me. Look, I mean, these are aesthetic discussions, right? If you like old-time country music, you're not going to like the new Nashville. If you like new heavy metal, you're going to think Kiss is cheesy. Maybe you won't. We often look for sort of technological justifications for our taste. And so people say, well, this auto-tune stuff, it's all so artificial. There's nothing more artificial than an authenticity-laced, like, old-timey country performance in a studio today where they bring in, like, a 50-year-old tape machine that's been rehabbed and reproduced, and they've sourced new old stock military tubes for the microphones, and then they've got these old instruments with like carefully maintained patina that they bought through collectors. Like it's just as artificial. The artifice is just in a different place. And so when I think about The Voice, one of the things that's interesting about it is it carries this cultural freight of authenticity, of being an expression of a person's interior state, who they really are. At the same time, it is one of the most disciplined, trained, standardized, regulated dimensions of human life and expression.
You mean like in terms of dictation or people who take singing training? I mean, how do we regulate the voice culturally?
In all sorts of ways. So, you know, where is it okay to talk loudly? Where is it, under what circumstances is it okay to talk quietly? You know, think about all the talk about vocal fry, right, as a problem with women's voices on radio, which really very quickly turns into like a referendum on whether women should be allowed to speak in public, which is, of course, ridiculous, right? It's just another sort of case of sexism rearing its ugly head.
I guess I'm wondering, how do technologies of The Voice challenge or reinforce what we think of as the politics of The Voice? Is there a sort of politics of The Voice?
There isn't one politics of The Voice. There are many politics of The Voice. The idea of having a voice, of course, goes all the way back to the Greeks, where the idea of democracy was a bunch of people in a physical space talking to one another. And our ideas of democracy are still very often tied to this. But it's a real problem. For one thing, sometimes people are forced to speak when they don't want to. Sometimes voice is not the source of agency. It can be the source of subjugation, right? You have a right mm-hmm. to remain silent. Mm-hmm. There's a reason you do. And it's interesting how few places in American life you still have that right. The second thing is to say that sonic differences are proxies for all sorts of other social differences that we are effectively managing out of public life. We're saying they should not be audible, when in fact, if they were audible, we might have a better sense of the sort of human variety that's all around us and ways to negotiate being different from one another, but still together and in some kind of collective.
Jonathan Stern is a professor in culture and technology at McGill University. His most recent book is called MP3, The Meaning of a Format. He talked with Craig Ely.